Hello and welcome to a special edition of The Stack. I had the pleasure to speak with the grandson of fashion legend Diana Vreeland. He just edited a book on her words of wisdom. A must read, I would say. We also speak with Margaret Brennan from CBS's Face the Nation, one of the best Sunday morning political programs there is. And finally, I chat surf journalism and the rise of female surfing with Lauren Hill. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, we discuss surf journalism with Lauren Hill, author of She Surf, The Rise of Female Surfing, plus Margaret Brennan from CBS's Face the Nation. But first, it's time to discuss Diana Vreeland, the fashion legend and iconic former editor-in-chief of Vogue. A new book called Bon Mot, Words of Wisdom from the Empress of Fashion, is out now, published by Rizzoli. The book is edited by Diana's grandson, Alexander Vreeland, with stunning illustrations by Luke Edward Hall. I spoke to Alexander how it was to grow up with such a magnificent grammar. And of course, we go through some of Diana's most memorable phrases.
Fashion is not just clothes, is it?
No, it's part of the daily air, and it changes all the time. You can even see the approaching of a revolution in clothes.
You know, I think that she had a passion for creativity and a real belief in creating one's dreams and finding one's voice and finding one's life and building one's life off of that. And those are such fundamental, wonderful values that they seem to remain relevant and current through good times and bad times.
Well, it is impressive how current it is, you know, when I've seen the documentary or even when I read some of the quotes, she feels she's very much in tune. She doesn't seem that person to just look at nostalgia. In fact, one of the quotes is that she can't stand nostalgia, right?
I think that that's what's really fascinating with her legacy is it's sort of like a great photograph. You know, a great photograph is ageless and you look at it and you just sort of wonder, well, this looks totally today. And then you realize that it was photographed 70 years ago. And I think that the same thing is really true with my grandmother. She has this sort of timeless quality, which is wonderful.
Tell us, Alexander, the process of research for the book. Of course, you are her grandson, but you know, is it true that a lot of those quotes actually she used to record some of them because she didn't send so many like notes or letters? I think she had an assistant as well who helped with some of the recordings. So tell us about this process of research.
You know, I found that. A lot of people would come and tell me that when they were going through a tough time, they would listen to the documentary on my grandmother or read some of her books, and that it would sort of recharge them and refocus them and sort of help them get through difficult times. And so I realized that it was really her words that had tremendous power of putting things into perspective and into helping people to sort of clarify, refine within themselves where they were in their lives or put things back into focus and perspective. And so I decided to do a book just of her quotes. And it's been quite a few years of work because, first of all, I didn't have enough time to really dedicate myself until recently, but I really wanted to go through all of her archives, all of her letters, all of her recordings, all of her books, all of her memos and letters that I could find in through her years at Vogue and her years at the Met and other files that we have in the family to pull out of those small pieces that I thought were relevant. And I didn't want to make it all into two-word logos as if I was sort of making a t-shirt collection. I really wanted to have some short and some a little bit longer that sort of had a interesting, fun perspective. And Then I culled them down to about 150. So that was the process.
How do you remember her as a grandmother? Because, you know, from what I know her, she looks incredibly fabulous with all those amazing quotes. But what about perhaps a little bit more in private? Was she the Diana Vreeland that we all know from the outside?
You know, she was a very good grandmother. I don't think she was a great mother, but I think she was a very good grandmother. And she was very involved in my brothers and my life. Nikki and I were born in Switzerland, and she would come and visit us pretty much every year and would spend 5 days to 2 weeks with us, wherever my father was posted. He was an American diplomat. And so we had a lot of time with them, and they were very generous, and they gave us lots of presents. And I think that since they were in New York and we were in different countries, they were sending us gift boxes all the time of fun things that we should be looking at or reading or playing with or wearing. So it was a very generous grandmother when I was a child. And then as I got older, a very attentive, very interested in me kind of person, which was really quite wonderful when you're a teenager in your 20s to have someone who's listening to you and asking you questions and not trying to tell you what to do with your life, but asking you about what are your passions and what are your interests and what are the things that you like to listen to or what movies you're enjoying. And I feel that sort of the way she approached life was very much sort of asking questions and finding out from young people what they were doing kept her young and connected. And so I always felt that there was that kind of respect for my voice at an early age, which was really quite wonderful. So we were really very close for all of the years we were together.
One thing that is quite inspirational about Diana, I think, is also her curiosity. I mean, one of the quotes actually that is in the book, but I remember also from the documentary, is her passion for surfing. You know, I wouldn't expect, you know, a Vogue editor saying that, but she said with so much passion. And there's a beautiful quote here in the book saying, "Surfing. I do think that surfing would be the most beautiful thing in the world to do." You know, I could see the passion when she said that. That's just incredible.
You know, what's interesting is that she had a very sort of a romanticized vision of life. And I think that one of the reasons that she was such a successful editor was she would send these photographers off to these locations to shoot with a group of models and hair and makeup and wardrobe of clothes. And then she'd have one conversation with the stylist or the photographer. There's a famous recording of Richard Avedon when she's sending him off to Egypt, and she just says to him, "Think of a young Cleopatra." And that was it. That's all that one little phrase is all that you need to say to someone like Richard Avedon. And the entire photo shoot was based upon that one concept. And so regardless of what Egypt looked like, you know, that's the world that Richard recreated, was a young, beautiful Cleopatra walking around in the 60s sort of thing. And so I've always sort of felt that she has this ability to sort of, in her own imagination, she sees things and then they come to life through her conversations.
And when you read some of the quotes, so you can see how extremely influential she is, and perhaps it still is. For example, I have a quote here that I think is fantastic. A little bad taste is like a nice splash of paprika, and we all need a splash of bad taste. No taste is what I am against. So in some ways, I do think Diana probably would enjoy some of the fashion scene that we're seeing today, because it seems to me that she was never going to be looking back. She would always kind of see what's new and coming up, right?
I really think so. I think that she, you know, she lived through the sort of the transition of the world from the fashion world only being a world of couture into a world of ready-to-wear. And there's never a quote of her saying, "Oh, it's so terrible that now these clothes are accessible," or, "Oh, it's so terrible that, you know, more people can wear these clothes," or whatever. So she wasn't somebody who spent her time trying to sort of, you know, reel history back to the good old days. I think that she was very much of an embracer of what was happening. And I think that, you know, in this times, she would be embracing what we're going to have next. And I don't think we all know what we're going to have next, but she would be, you know, open to it and into it.
And one thing I have to mention about the book as well, besides the fantastic quotes, there's also beautiful illustration as well.
I was very fortunate. I've been working with Sam Shahid, who's the art director for my last two books. And Sam is a very important art director. And he did the layout and the typography. And he suggested that I look up Luke Edward Hall, who I had not known and has become a friend, a young British illustrator who I really feel channels Cocteau, because there's this amazing strong lines that Jean Cocteau used to have. And he came on board and just really brought the book to life. I think that his drawings just were transformative and made the book much more fun, open, easy, spirited. And he sort of opens the whole thing up from what could have been a much more serious book. I think the drawings are just wonderful. And he seized my grandmother's spirit in the drawings and did a whole bunch of drawings of her that are just imaginative and lovely.
Alexander, sorry for the difficult question now, but if you could choose one quote, I wouldn't say necessarily your favorite, but that always stay in your mind and that it is in the book.
I love the quote and I put it in the back cover. And it says, "I believe you see in the dream. I think we only live through our dreams and imagination. That's the only reality we really ever know." And I think that that's really important, because I think that this is a quality that she really brought into people's lives, is the world of imagination, the world of dreams, from the point of view of creating yourself, following your dreams, from the perspective of, you know, being really creative and successful in a creative field by going inside and finding, you know, what are your own visions and how you can listen to them. And I think it sort of has sort of transformative quality that it comes from within, which I think is wonderful.
I think to just have little bites out of the fashion world is a sort of a starvation diet myself. I'd rather keep right out and eat ice cream cake all day, look terrible and feel fine. Or I'd like to be bang in it as I've been for so many years.
That was Alexander Vreeland. Beaumont, Words of Wisdom from the Empress of Fashion, is out now. And now to the world of TV. Sunday morning television political programs are a staple of U.S. broadcasting. CBS Face the Nation is one of the most storied of these programs. It debuted in 1954. Margaret Brennan is the show's current moderator, a post she has held since 2018. During the coronavirus outbreak in the U.S., viewing figures have soared, and its coverage has brought in new audiences. Our U.S. election correspondent, Thomas Lewis, spoke to Margaret Brennan for the June issue of Monaco, and he began by asking her when the coronavirus outbreak had first come to her attention.
We first started, I'd have to check the exact dates, but we first started talking, covering it in January when then still very mysterious virus was hitting China so dramatically. And that stood out to me at the time, just knowing, it's the second largest economy in the world. It is a huge geostrategic factor in terms of, you know, how they're doing will impact how we fare as well. And, you know, just my background covering global economics and foreign policy made it stand out to me. But I don't think any of us had any sense of what it would become here in the United States, that it would be this unprecedented event that would literally completely change the way we're living in this country. Certainly the way I approach things as I try to see how those dots connect. And to me, going into a presidential election year, when the president of the United States is running on a strong economy, as at that point, his greatest selling point, the greatest geopolitical and economic rival to the United States suddenly being brought to its knees and crippled because of a virus, seemed blatantly obvious to me was a huge story, because it could impact us back in the United States. I was looking at it from a rival, geopolitical rivalry and economic point of view. at that point, I think all of us believed the health experts in the guidance that was being provided, which was that this wasn't something that posed a direct threat to Americans' health and well-being in an obvious way. And then the health experts were kind of overcome by circumstance and information, and now point back to imperfect data coming out from China that really kind of obscured exactly how transmissible this virus was. So in hindsight, a lot of these things, you know, seem obvious, but at the time as we were going through them, we were living through this huge change. You know, I feel like the earth has kind of come off its axis a little bit, and we were just chronicling that happening. But those were sort of some of the threads that we had started pulling and following that brought us to where we are right now. And that's kind of how we've covered that through the crisis, is telling people what we're seeing coming, telling people why it is important, not necessarily getting caught up in the politics of it, the partisanship of it, but rather, particularly in this moment, when people are worried about their own health and well-being, trying to get to the information people need to know.
From your vantage point, how do you characterize the way the messages, you know, from the White House have been throughout this? And then I suppose a follow-on question would be, you know, how have you at the program aimed to sort of counter that or sort of shed light on it?
Well, look, I think this crisis has kind of hit us at the seams of our society, at the weakest parts of our society. It's exploiting almost every single one of those weak seams. If it's the, you know, socioeconomic separations between us, if it's the partisanship, if it's the distrust of authority and those who are in those positions of authority and the information and expertise they convey, whether that's Congress, whether that's the media, you know, it's this all-out assault on that connective tissue, or the seams, as I'm saying, at once, that has just shown us sort of the most extreme version of the problem that is being described with our political paralysis in this country. It's getting back to, for us, at least in the small segment that we hold on to as journalists, where we are supposed to be there to help keep the electorate informed. You know, trust in the information we're conveying is central. I mean, your integrity and the trust in the information you're conveying is everything. And in a moment of crisis, it becomes just that much more valuable to people. So I think everyone in a position of authority, certainly I feel that responsibility, and I know the producers on the shows do too, which is you've got to be as well-read, as well-researched, as up-to-date, and as clear as you can be in explaining to people and walking them through what is happening and why. You know, not just describing the problem, but trying to get the decision makers and policymakers who are looking for solutions to that problem. Something we're choosing to do in our space, on our hour on Sundays, is to try to take the politics out of it. And so people aren't receiving things well. They're not receiving the information they need when there is, you know, a food fight in the middle of it. And that's unfortunately, I think, where a lot of these briefings end up. Gray is very uncomfortable for people. And those gray areas are often where the truth actually is.
Your viewing numbers are the highest for some time. Are you seeing new audiences come into the program? And are there sort of people who maybe hadn't engaged with the Strand, which is one of the most storied in US broadcasting, that haven't really engaged with them before, do you think? Who's tuning in to you now? And I suppose maybe a bit more of a flavor of what some of those interactions with you personally have been like.
Yeah, no, we've really been struck by that, because I think it confirms what our instincts were. Certainly, you know, my instinct, my executive producer's instinct, Mary Hager, has been tremendous in bringing us back to that core, what do people need to know question each week. And I think that is what we're seeing reflected, which is there is a hunger for facts. There is a hunger for reality checks. People don't want to be spun right now. They don't want to be engaged in some of I think what has passed for political conversations in this country, which are not so much based on what matters to people at their very human level. I mean, we are literally talking about kitchen table economics and people's life and death. And by the way, their own well-being. You know, it is the essence of how we function in our societies and the political bodies that we make up as a result of it. And I think we're testing the limits of our political systems and our institutions right now. This is really the ultimate stress test of American democracy.
CBS Face the Nation moderator Margaret Brennan speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis. And you can read Margaret's insights into broadcasting throughout the pandemic in the June issue of Monocle magazine, which is available now. And now it's time to surf. I've always been fascinated by surfing, even though I'm not very good at it. It's one of the most beautiful sports there is. It brings me peace. Diana Vreeland, which we spoke a while ago here on the Stack, would agree with me. Here is a clip of her talking about her love for surfing.
But you know, I'm really only envious of one thing, and that is a surfer. I think it's the most beautiful thing. See, I'm mad about water. I think water is God's tranquilizer. To be in it, to drink it, to look at it, and to be a surfer, between the sky and the water, would be, to me, the most wonderful thing. I'm sorry, I just didn't make it. Also, skateboards, I think, are great. Great!
That was Diana Vreeland telling us how much she loves surfing. Well, talking about surfing, I had the pleasure to speak with professional surfer and writer Lauren L. Hill, who just published a book with Gestalten called She Surf, The Rise of Female Surfing. We spoke about surf journalism and how women have a long history in the world of surfing. Let's hear it.
I've dedicated, the last 20 years or so to making and living a surfing life, and it's been fascinating to see it really ripple out and to see more and more people taking up surfing all around the world. And amongst those people, more and more women in really unexpected parts of the world, in places like India and the Gaza Strip and Sri Lanka and Indonesia. And yeah, that's sort of an easy seg into my book, which highlights a lot of those women and the ways that they're really shaping their cultures and their communities and redefining femininity and womanhood in some ways within their own communities.
What I love about the book, of course, you profile, you know, female surfers today, and they're very good, but also there's a little bit of history. I didn't know, for example, the Polynesian surfing princesses, you know, so there's a long, long history there when it comes to female surfing, right?
Yeah, there really is. And, you know, one of the sort of downfalls of surf culture right now is that there really aren't many outlets for women's surfing culture to live. We haven't really seen, you know, so-called men's surf magazines integrate women's surfing into their media depictions so wholeheartedly, I would say. And so it's difficult. I think a lot of women don't feel a connection or don't have an understanding of the long and abundant history of water women. And so that was something I really wanted to make a point of writing and sharing and doing the proper research for in my book, just to make sure there was a constant place, a place that wasn't going to get buried in the ephemera of the internet for women to, yeah, touch base with their history as water people.
And just coming back before we talk more about the book, I mean, about your career, you're a professional, but you're also a writer. So when you were writing for, you know, surf magazines or when you were writing about surf, did you notice that it was very male-focused, that industry?
Yeah, I guess it really started from when I was a grommet myself. I grew up on a barrier island just off the coast of Florida. And I had a dream about surfing, and I knew the next day I had to try. I had to start surfing, and I convinced a friend, a young guy who was my age, to push me into waves, and he did, and he was amazing. And then as I grew into my surfing life, I was the only girl around, really, and I had a little pack of boys that I hung out with, and that was fine until we started getting a little bit older, and we started engaging with surf brands and surf media a little bit more, and I noticed how women were just treated differently in the surf space, and often with a very objectifying and sexualized approach, especially within surf media at that time through the 2000s. And so it made me feel really insecure as a young girl that all my guy friends were just, you know, part of the boy pack, and I was different as I was growing breasts and maturing, and that was really uncomfortable.
At the same time, I mean, I was very happy to find out in your book that actually last year, now the elite professionals, men and women, are paid the same. Probably surfing still has lots to catch up, but that's quite a major first step, right?
It is. It's a major first step, and it's a benchmark, you know. It's an aspiration for all of surf culture and other sports as well to aspire to. I think there's a lot of work to do in reforming cultural attitudes, but I think that will come. And I think the WSL should definitely be applauded for making that stand and asserting equality as a priority in our sport.
What I love about your book as well, it's such a complete guide. There was a lovely story about how women have also been involved with surfboard design. So it's not just a beautiful images of female surfers, but also, you know, there's the behind the scenes, you know, so they're also actually working in the proper industry. That was a great story, I have to say, if you could tell us a bit more about it.
Thank you. Yeah, that was something I was really proud to include in the book, because that's something that really comes from my intimate knowledge and experience within the surf industry, being able to tease out these little threads that, you know, women aren't often thought of as having engaged with the design and shaping of surf crafts, but there still is a rich history, you know, dating back to Joey Hamasaki in the 50s and 60s, and then Cher Pendarvis, who is a great surfboard shaper and artist from the 60s right up to today. She's still shaping. And there's a legacy that women should be proud of. And there's no reason why women shouldn't be in shaping bays today. And I think, it's a growing section of surfboard design to see women getting involved and getting their hands dirty in the shaping bay.
And by the way, are you still surfing every day where you are? I'm sure the situation is much freer now in Australia.
Yeah, we've been so fortunate here, and our beaches have been open all through the lockdown, and we've been able to surf every day, which has been incredible. And also, I can't imagine it having been any other way in Australia, because Australians are fundamentally beach people. That's one of the reasons why I love living here so much.
In the book also, you mentioned some of the best places to surf and everything, but do you have a favorite place that perhaps is a bit closer to your heart? I mean, you mentioned there are some places in Italy, the Maldives and many others.
Yeah, they're all places that I've been to and spent time and made friends and surfed incredible waves. So they all have, you know, a personal flavor for me. But one of my favorite trips was to the Seychelles, just for its remoteness. It's still quite a pristine and wild place, and surf culture really isn't taking root there yet. So it felt like, you know, surf explorers must have felt in the many decades before there were guidebooks, and certainly before there was the internet to check every aspect of swell direction and surf cams and all that. So it was really the kind of place where you get to go and you just have to be sensitive, pay attention to what the wind and swell are doing, and follow your nose. And sometimes you win and sometimes you don't. And that's kind of the beauty of the adventure.
That was Lauren L. Hill. Her book, She Surfed, The Rise of Female Surfing, is out now. That's it for this week's show. My thanks as always to our editor, Nora Hull. If you have any comments or queries, write to me, Fernando, at fb@monaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to it again at monaco.com or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And don't forget, of course, you can always subscribe to Monaco as well on our website. And to end the show and continue the surf vibe, this is the classic song by The Sandals, Theme from Endless Summer, you know, the iconic 60s surfing documentary. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.